طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This morning we feature an extended interview of Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima, one of the most thorough critics of Israel's occupation and colonization of his homeland. Ali Abu Nima is the co-founder and executive director of the widely acclaimed publication The Electric Intifada, a non-profit independent online publication focusing on Palestine. He is joined by Walter Hickson, distinguished professor of history at the University of Akron, and the author of numerous studies, including most recently Israel's Armor, The Israel Lobby and the First Generation of the Palestine Conflict, published by Cambridge University. This conversation is sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C. Walter Hickson begins with a question to Ali Abu Nima.
So, Ali, just to kick things off, for people who don't know, tell us about, you know, your background and how you got involved in the long struggle for justice in Palestine.
Well, hi, Walter. And it's having previously attended and participated in the conference live, I'm happy to do it virtually and look forward to when we can meet again in person. And I'm very pleased that UMEP and the Washington Report are continuing this important work. So I just want to say how happy I am to be here. Well, now you're asking me to delve back into the far depths of my memory, farther than I usually like to go. You know, as people know, I am of Palestinian descent. And so the question of Palestine has always been in my life and in my family. You know, for that, I definitely credit my parents. But really, it was, I think, when I went to university, I came to the United States to go to university and began to see just how utterly distorted, depraved, and just having no basis in reality, the discourse was about Palestine. And I would see articles in newspapers, whether it was campus newspapers or the New York Times, that just completely contradicted what I knew to be the reality. And so I started to question why that was the case and just felt really an instinctive need to respond to it, first by writing letters and eventually by trying to participate in the media to the extent that I could, but finding really every door closed or virtually closed. And then I think with the advent of the internet in the 1990s, when that became much more widespread, we found that we could actually start to communicate with each other. There were listservs. These were basically groups by email where people would share news and views and opinions, which was just a fantastically powerful tool at the time. And then the World Wide Web, which we all take for granted now. And when we started the Electronic Intifada about 20 years ago, unbelievably to me, we must be one of the oldest continuously running news websites in the world at this point. It was initially a response, you know, we were responding to media, sort of hitting back at inaccurate coverage. And then we thought, hang on a minute, we can actually start doing our own coverage and creating our own media. And that's really where it began. And here we are still doing it. And I know we're going to talk about this question, but what worries me very much is that the opportunity the internet provided for us to reach a global audience at very low cost, that I'm afraid that window is closing now as we see more and more online censorship.
Yeah, it's certainly a threat, and we're going to come back to that later today. Thank you for that. We have in the title of the webinar today, the president, and obviously we have a new president elect, whether the current one will ever admit it or not. So want to ask you about your expectations for Biden. Before we do that, though, Grant's got a nice little film clip to share with us. There's the Electronic Intifada site.
Look at the Middle East. I think it's about time we stop, those of us who support, as most of us do, Israel in this body, for apologizing for our support for Israel. There's no apology to be made. None. It is the best $3 billion investment we make. Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region. The United States would have to go out and invent an Israel.
So that gives us a sense of maybe what we can expect or not expect from the Biden administration. I recently made the conclusion that Trump is the second most enabling president in American history of Israel behind Lyndon Johnson. Given all that Trump did, you might expect some change with Biden, or do you?
Well, just thank you for showing that clip. That is from 1986 in the Senate. And of course, it's a very frank admission of how Biden saw and sees Israel still as really a tool of U.S. imperialism. He wouldn't use that word, but I think that's what it is. And it's also funny, it just struck me, where he's talking about supporting Israel as if it's this courageous position where you have to fight back all these attacks. Who in 1986 in the United States Senate was making anyone apologize for supporting Israel? I mean, the idea that he was taking a courageous position just shows just so much of the fakery around political discussions of Israel then and now in the United States. But Biden has been consistent on this issue. It's perhaps one of the few issues where he's been absolutely rock solid in his support for Israel from the beginning of his career until the present day. And in terms of sort of the immediate contrast or non-contrast with Trump, you know, Trump took some unprecedented steps in terms of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, formally recognizing Israel's settlements in the West Bank, formally recognizing the annexation of East Jerusalem, the annexation of the Golan Heights, cutting off practically all U.S. aid to the Palestinians, including to hospitals in East Jerusalem and to schools and clinics in refugee camps. So that's what distinguished Trump from his predecessors. But I think that also can be conceals the amount of continuity between Trump and the Obama-Biden administration, and before that, the Bush administration and Clinton and so on, in the sense that the so-called peace plan, what's come to be known as the deal of the century that Trump pushed, of a truncated Palestinian Bantustan on a fraction of the West Bank with no real sovereignty and no real control over its fate and destiny, really is, I think, much more in tune with, let's say, the Clinton parameters. These were the parameters that Bill Clinton set out for a so-called peace deal just before he left office in late 2000. And so Trump was simply saying out loud what people in the Obama and Biden administration thought but wouldn't say out loud. So Biden has already said he's not moving the embassy back. I would be very surprised if he revokes the recognition of East Jerusalem as the Israeli, as part of Israel, and Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I'll be very surprised if he revokes the recognition of the Golan Heights. So what can we hope for at best? Well, the Biden administration has said that they will restore humanitarian aid to Palestinians. And to the extent that that will get more money to schools and hospitals where it's needed for a very vulnerable population, that's a good thing. But we have to remember that U.S. aid and international aid generally has been used to keep the Palestinians on life support while Israel has been allowed to continue aggressively stealing and colonizing Palestinian land, bombing Gaza, killing Palestinians, carrying out massacres. And, you know, I was talking to a friend the other day who pointed out that, well, as awful as Trump has been, we have thankfully, for whatever reason, not seen the kind of large-scale massacres of Palestinians that we saw when Israel bombed Gaza in 2014. Of course, that's little consolation because Israel carried out the slow-motion massacre during the Great March of Return in 2018 of more than 200 unarmed Palestinian civilians over a period of 9 months or something. So I'm not trying to claim that there's a big difference there. What I'm saying is that from that perspective, Trump hasn't been dramatically worse than Obama and Biden, and I don't expect Biden to be dramatically better than Trump. What we may see is a return to the sort of empty peace process language and phraseology of constantly talking about a two-state solution, a bit of hand-wringing about Israeli settlements, but no action. And one final point on this is that, Benjamin Netanyahu was one of the last sort of high-profile world leaders to congratulate President-elect Biden after some delay, where I'm sure the Israelis was figuring out, what do we do here? And immediately, Israeli defense officials were telling media that, oh, we're going to go to the Biden administration within months to start talking about the next U.S. military aid package to Israel. And the context for that is that the Obama-Biden administration gave Israel the biggest military aid package in the history of humanity as one of its final acts. The Obama administration guaranteed Israel a minimum of $38 billion in U.S. military aid over 10 years. And the Israelis know that if you want to at least match that or increase it, Biden is the guy to go to.
Yeah, you make a number of very important points. And one I'd just like to underscore is you use the term continuity. And I think it's so important for people to understand that regardless of party and administration, there's been tremendous continuity over generations in pro-Israeli U.S. Policy. And yes, to have Biden speaking in the mid-80s about pressure on Israel when settlement building was raging in the Reagan 1980s is quite ironic. So continuing with this theme, do you have any, I'm sure you have hope, but any realistic prospect, do you see any realistic prospect for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party to be able to bring any meaningful pressure to bear to counter all the lobby pressure and what Israel is going to come back to the table, as you note, asking for no doubt a higher, even higher levels of new military assistance?
Yeah, I think if you were just to look at sort of the elite echelon of the Democratic Party, You know, the Barack Obamas, the Hillary Clintons, of course, the Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. If you're just to look at them, you would see very little change. You would think actually that U.S. pro-Israel discourse has not changed since the 1980s or the 1990s. But that masks what has been happening within the base of the Democratic Party over a number of years, which is that Israel has lost a great deal of support and Palestinian rights have become central to many left-wing and progressive movements in the Western world, including here in the United States. And we see that reflected in the rhetoric of some of these new so-called progressives, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, who I think has been one of the I don't always agree with her, but she's been one of the clearest and most courageous voices on Palestine, as well as a number of other foreign policy issues. And so I think the question of whether we'll see progress on this issue or the progressive wing having an impact on this issue is tied to the bigger question of whether the progressive wing will have an impact on the party overall.
Yeah.
Not just on Palestine, but on issues like, you know, Medicare for all and on economic issues and so on. And there is clearly a civil war. Maybe that's not the right term, but a very fierce conflict within the Democratic Party between the corporatist elites and these progressives. And it's unclear to me at this point whether the progressives are actually going to challenge the corporate establishment. I think an early test will be to see whether they are willing to put up a challenger to Nancy Pelosi when she seeks re-election as Speaker, given Pelosi's disastrous performance in the election, having actually lost seats, you know, just barely maintaining the Democratic majority in a year when they were expected to gain seats. And so that will be a first test. But whether that, you know, that's not going to be resolved now. These are long-term, generational, cultural, political changes that are going on within the Democratic Party and more broadly on the left in the United States that are going to continue. And I think the trend for people who care about Palestinian rights is generally positive and encouraging, but the question is, when is that going to translate into policy change at the upper level? Remember, as recently as the 2020 primary campaign, the corporate Democratic Party establishment managed to exclude even the word occupation from its platform when talking about Palestine. So they're not even willing to mention Israeli occupation. The battle is still to be fought.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an uphill battle for them. And we'll see if they get any meaningful presidential appointments as well as Pelosi's fate. So one thing I think we can count on is that AIPAC will exert a lot of influence. And one of the interesting things, there was a piece in the Washington Report, current edition, about AIPAC will be resurgent after Trump, because after all, with Trump, they get pretty much everything they want. So I wonder if you think that might be the case. And as much as we may doubt whether progressive wing of the Democratic Party will have influence, given the Biden clip that we showed and the long history and the continuity we've discussed, we can be certain AIPAC is going to try to exert a lot of influence. So do you think it will be sort of resurgent, or can it be any more resurgent?
I think AIPAC will be very comfortable with the Biden administration for a number of reasons. One is that Trump's often openly anti-Semitic rhetoric, where he would attack Jewish Americans for being insufficiently pro-Israel and even refer to Benjamin Netanyahu as their prime minister. His association with white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups, which sometimes went far beyond dog whistles to more or less open support. you know, hardcore Israel supporters are actually fine with that. We saw, for example, someone like Sebastian Gorka, a Trump advisor, who is a member of a Nazi group in Hungary, being invited to give a speech at the, or was invited as a guest of honor at the Zionist Organization of America. So there are groups that are quite comfortable with that. But for some of the more liberal pro-Israel groups, or the ones who pose as liberal, it was a very uncomfortable situation. They were very happy with Trump's, pro-Israel policies, but had a hard time defending his anti-Semitism and white supremacy. So they will be comfortable with Biden because Biden won't engage in that kind of thing. Perhaps more significant on a policy level is, of course, Trump also, as part of his America First populism, had this somewhat contrarian streak when it came to U.S. intervention around the world. He often talked about withdrawing U.S. Forces from around the world. He never did it, not in any significant numbers. He would talk about it. But Biden is, I don't think, going to be like that. We've already seen in terms of the transition team, Biden inviting people like Dana Sproul from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy onto the agency review team for the State Department, basically the team that manages the transition into the State Department. And Sproul is somebody who, you know, is a regime change advocate, very pro-Israel, of course. The Washington Institute, not to be confused with the Washington Report, of course. We're talking about the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is a cutout of AIPAC. It was actually set up by AIPAC primarily to promote Israel's interests. So the neocons and neoliberal warmongers from places like the Washington Institute will find a very welcome, find the Biden administration a very welcoming place to push their policies. And of course, Biden allows them to once again present support for Israel as a quote unquote bipartisan issue, whereas under Trump, it became an increasingly polarized Republican versus Democrat issue.
Yeah, so the Iran looms large, as always, with matters pertaining to Israel. And the Iran treaty, obviously, Trump torpedoed. Do you have a sense at all of what Biden's approach to that will be? Do you think he will try to reassert Obama's? It was a linchpin of Obama's diplomacy. Obama, as we were talking earlier, didn't make much of an impact at all or change policy toward Palestine, but he tried with Iran. Where do you think that'll go?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm a very, very strong critic of Obama, and I always have been, and I've been reading his new book. I have some things, maybe we'll have time to get into that. But and he was terrible on Palestine. And but I say that as a preface to say, I think that, of all the options, the Iran deal was a net positive because it was about not going to war. It was about, allowing Iran to be able to trade and to be able to have normal relations with the world. And the Iranians embraced it in that sense. It was the U.S. that reneged on the deal and pulled out under Trump. Biden has not said, on day one, I'm going to go straight back into the Iran deal. He's not said that. He said that he would rejoin as long as Iran is in compliance. And that language, I think, opens the door for Biden and for Israel and for its lobby to push to try to force changes in the deal, which are to Iran's disadvantage. And, what would be the countervailing forces to that? Well, you'd have to look at the other participants in the Iran deal, particularly the European Union, will they stand up to the United States? Will they say, no, you need to sign up to the deal that the U.S. agreed to, and you need to come, you, the U.S. needs to come back into compliance with the Iran deal. The Europeans are not going to do that. They've never shown a spine when it comes to the United States. And particularly now, when they're just so relieved and happy to have another sort of neoliberal transatlanticist back in the White House, they're not going to want a confrontation with the United States. So it's hard to know what will happen. I'll just say I would be very surprised if Biden simply rejoins the deal, no fuss, and says, let's get back to the deal we agreed to after so much difficult negotiation. I think there's going to be all kinds of shenanigans going on with Israel trying to put pressure on Biden not to sign up, or at least not to sign up without demanding more concessions. And that's not going to be good news.
Yeah, I think that's really good analysis of the situation. And that treaty and Iran itself have been so demonized during this Republican administration that I think it, even if Biden wanted to, I think it'd be hard to walk in and say, I'm just re-upping it. So I think something along what you outline is where it's going to go. And it'll be a real struggle if anything happens. We were talking about the lobby, and you mentioned the discomfort of liberal Jewish groups, or groups that perceive themselves as liberal, with Trump's rhetoric, although I'm astonished you would make such a claim about the least racist person in the world, but you did. So seriously, the there's AIPAC, which, you know, was comfortable with Netanyahu, and many of its cohorts are comfortable with Trump, but there is also J Street, and there are other groups putatively liberal Zionists. So they seem to be, you know, more and more active and vocal. And unlike AIPAC, they got Democratic candidates to their virtual conference, to the most recent one, which some of the liberal Democratic candidates boycotted the AIPAC conference. So how do you see the role of J Street and other, you know, liberal Zionist groups? Do they offer hope at all for justice in Palestine?
Well, of course, the short answer is no. Liberal Zionist groups, you know, the Israel lobby has become polarized along party lines. So even though AIPAC tries to present itself as, you know, bipartisan, it's increasingly associated with the Republican Party or with the pro-Israel right and far right, and is even seeing competition to its right from groups like the Israeli American Council, you know, efforts to outflank them on the right. Whereas J Street has become sort of the comfortable home for Democrats who try to appease the base of the party, who are increasingly angry about what Israel is doing to Palestinians. So J Street offers sort of a slightly softer face to the Israel lobby. But when it comes to substance, J Street is very anti-Palestinian. They oppose Palestinian refugee rights on the racist grounds that if you're not Jewish, you don't get to come back to your homeland. They oppose the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is, of course, a nonviolent Palestinian-led struggle to put pressure on Israel to respect Palestinian rights. You know, they're a Zionist group. They're about preserving Israel as a state where Jews maintain political, economic, demographic dominance, and Palestinians have at best minority rights. And they see a two-state solution as a central way to save Israel in that form. Of course, with the collapse of the two-state solution, liberal Zionism really has nowhere to go. And the key sort of moment, the seminal moment we saw over the last few months, I think, was Peter Beinart basically renouncing the two-state model. Peter Beinart, as many viewers will know, has been one of the most prominent liberal Zionist polemicists over the past few years. And in a piece he wrote in July in Jewish Current, he basically said that the struggle that liberal Zionists like himself have been waging for many decades to separate Jews and Palestinians into two separate states has failed, and it is now time to stop fighting for Jewish and Palestinian separation and to start fighting for Jewish and Palestinian equality. And he also wrote a piece in the New York Times following up on that with the rather dramatic title, "I No Longer Believe in a Jewish State." And Beinart's, you know, of course, Beinart wasn't saying anything that Palestinians haven't been saying for many, many years, but it was significant in terms of, I think, where many liberal Zionists are and many Jewish Americans are in terms of their thinking about Israel. And I think it's going to be very hard to put that, you know, to put that genie back in the bottle, so to speak. So liberal Zionism is really has really got nowhere to go.
Yeah, I think that was important what Beinart said and did, and you know, hopefully we'll hear more of that and move it in the only direction, as you say, it has to go.
Yeah, and another thing, if I could just mention, yeah, sure. You know, sort of related to this, that I think is a sign of the changing times is, you know, in the last couple of months, Peace Americans for Peace Now, you know, one sort of the main liberal Zionist pro-peace process group, was holding its online gala honoring Yitzhak Rabin. And you might remember that after Palestinians spoke out, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, pulled out of that because, as Palestinians pointed out, Rabin was no hero. He was a war criminal from day one until his dying day. The peace process he sponsored was fake. And to me, that just really showed the way things are changing in terms of the discourse, because a few years ago, Rabin was a saint, you know, and everyone worshipped at the altar of Rabin, the martyred peacemaker. And for us to be able now to actually talk frankly about Rabin as a war criminal, as an apartheid administrator who never wanted to give Palestinians their rights, is a sea change. And I think we have to tie that to what we saw over the summer in the past few years. If we're going to topple statues of slave-owning founding fathers, if we're going to talk honestly about the history of the United States, well, then we also have to be able to talk honestly about the history and the founding of Israel. So these things are happening at the same time, and they are related.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because you know, something that really could be hopeful would be a linkage of the Black Lives Matter movement with, you know, if you're going to crusade, as well people should, for racial justice in the United States, you know, the hypocrisy of enabling it in Palestine should be brought home to these.
And that is happening. You know, over the past few years, there have been incredible statements from Black leaders and Black movements in the United States expressing solidarity with Palestinians. There have been delegations to Palestine. There are ongoing exchanges. And that continues, I should say, a tradition that goes back to the 1960s, when we saw you know, Black radical thinkers seeing the Black struggle in the United States as part of a global anti-imperialist and anti-colonial struggle, and therefore seeing solidarity with Palestine as a natural outgrowth of their politics. That, I think, went into abeyance in the civil rights and post-civil rights period, when the situation of Black people in the United States was presented in isolation, or thought about in isolation and not thought about in terms of a global struggle against empire and colonialism. So a lot of that thinking is is being highlighted again. And I should say this is one of the reasons, because of that courageous leadership from Black thinkers and activists in the United States, that's one of the reasons why Israel and its lobby have identified the Black Lives Matter movement as an enemy.
Yes.
And I've written about that. And this is not, you know, it's quite specific that they view Black Lives Matter as a risk to the U.S.-Israel relationship, precisely because the movement and thinkers within it are making these kinds of connections.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up on a couple of things you mentioned earlier, contrast to the limitations, which you clearly pointed out, of the so-called liberal Zionist groups, I think Jewish Voice for Peace has endorsed BDS and was very active in giving Ilhan Omar and others.
I wouldn't include them in the category.
I don't think
of Jewish Voice for Peace in that category at all. And other Jewish groups, because Jewish Voice for Peace, fully supports the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. They made a statement rejecting Zionism. Of course, as any organization, they're looking for a consensus. But among their members, you find many who are, very strongly and very staunchly anti-Zionist. But I certainly don't include Jewish Voice for Peace. They're not the same as J Street.
Yep. Yeah, that's the point I think worth making. You also, just quickly mentioned Rabin, and I'll just say that, I worked through in depth the material after the June 1967 war, and Rabin was an absolute architect of the occupation and repression. And for, I wouldn't argue with your depiction of him as a war criminal at all. He was an architect of the repression. So, it's very simplistic just to celebrate him as a courageous advocate of peace. So I'm glad you pointed that out. Let's move on to another facet of the Trump policy. His son-in-law orchestrated was bringing in these Arab regimes, three of them, to recognize Israel as part of this quote unquote deal of the century. How do you see all that? Is it important in terms of, should we expect more of it? What did Israel and the lobby gain out of that they can build on? Or do you think it's ephemeral?
I don't think it's ephemeral, because what they were doing was bringing out into the open deep and longstanding relationships between these Gulf regimes and Israel. These relationships go back at least to the 1990s in the case of the United Arab Emirates. And in recent years, we've seen them cozying up to Israel more or less openly. So it was a formalization of those ties. And I think to understand what's going on, you have to look at the bigger context. These are all client regimes and protectorates of the United States. And these regimes cannot exist without the imperial sponsorship and support of the United States. And that is true with Israel as well. As much as Israel likes to present itself or market itself as, this little Sparta that can look after itself, of course it can't. And as much as Israel makes of its own, weapons technology and arms industry, the weapons that really allow Israel to project power and to project terror across the region are all American weapons. You'll remember that when Israel tried to make its own fighter jet in the 1980s, the Lavi, it was an absolute disaster. The thing was, a lemon, so to speak. So Israel is totally dependent on the United States. And so these client regimes of the United States, whether it's in the UAE or Bahrain or Saudi Arabia or Israel, have a common interest in getting together. For one thing, they can be a collective lobby. They're sort of strength in numbers. They can help each other lobby the government and the imperial master in Washington for the things they want or need. And of course, the umbrella for this was is the U.S. bringing them together in the framework of its desire for confrontation with Iran. And that desire comes from the fear that Iran, with you know a population of 80 or 90 people, a lot of natural resources, a lot of ingenuity, has the potential to be a regional power and a regional rival. And so it comes from a U.S. imperial determination to keep Iran down at any price, including the price of imposing horrific sanctions, which stop Iranians from getting medicine and getting spare parts for airliners so that they can travel safely and so on. That's the framework for these agreements. So, you know, there's a symbolic loss for Palestinians in that, you know, there's the shattering of a united front in terms of Palestinian rights. But in reality, that was so threadbare. And these regimes have not been an asset to the Palestinian cause for many years, if ever.
Okay, that's a really fascinating assessment. It's more complex, I think, than a lot of people realize. Let's shift a little bit to, you know, one of the most pernicious things about the injustice in Palestine is, I mean, it's kind of two fronts. And the most horrific, of course, is in Palestine, where it destroys people's lives and literally kills people. But it's in the process of trying to kill civil liberties in this country. That's another front, and free speech. And as we talked at the outset, you started the Electronic Intifada, you and other media, internet, and online sources to battle this. And now there's, you know, the lobby and others recognize that, and they begin to act on that front as well. So can you talk about some of the threats of censorship and intrusions? Certainly, I'm very well aware of it from an academic setting and the climate on campuses and the attacks against Student for Justice in Palestine and the repression that goes on against speakers. But you can lump that in if you'd like. But definitely talk about in terms of your platform and other similar platforms. How do you see this effort by Zoom, Google, Facebook, and others to and where do we stand with all that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very disturbing because I think it was 2 years ago at the Israel Lobby conference, I spoke about the dangers of Russiagate, the narrative that the Democrats put out in the wake of their defeat in 2016, that Trump's victory had all been orchestrated by Russia. And, you know, this is something that was that a lot of people bought into. And you ask them, well, where's the evidence? Oh, but, you know, I read it in the New York Times or I saw it on CNN. But, you know, there was never any evidence. And then they put all this faith in the Mueller report, which, again, turned out to nothing. And then Ukrainegate and the impeachment, again, nothing. I mean, it was a gift to Trump in the sense that when he said there's no collusion, he turned out to be right. They could never really pin anything on him. Unfortunately, there's been no reckoning with that reality. However, one of the major outgrowths of that was the demands, you know, because the fake narrative was that, you know, Russia had used Facebook to spread disinformation that had somehow, you know, influenced American voters. Nobody ever found, to my knowledge, no one has located a single voter who was impacted by any of this and changed their vote or decided not to vote because of some Russian meme they saw on Facebook. It never happened. But what did happen was a lot of demands from Democrats, from liberals, even from people on the left for, oh, Facebook has to crack down on disinformation. And as we warned, you know, a few years ago, the first victims of this will be people on the left and people who dissent against U.S. foreign policy. And that is precisely what happened. And Palestinians have, as usual, been the canary in the coal mine who have suffered the brunt of the censorship first and foremost. And the recent examples we've seen is Zoom, the very platform we're using right now, which has a near monopoly status, shutting down university seminars because they have involved Leila Khaled, a Palestinian resistance icon, a member of the PFLP. And this has happened because of pressure from Israel and its lobby on Zoom, telling them you can't do this, overriding even the judgment of university teachers and university administrators who say it's in the interest of academic freedom and free inquiry and free speech for us to have these seminars. But an unaccountable Silicon Valley corporation imposed its own judgment and censored these events and shut them down. And we've seen Facebook and Twitter doing the same thing. And the problem is, you can say, well, the First Amendment only applies to the government. So these are private corporations and the First Amendment doesn't apply. That's true. But look at the world we live in. We're dependent on these privately owned platforms. Universities are dependent on Zoom. For our public discourse to have any semblance of political participation, we are increasingly dependent on Facebook and Twitter and others who act as the de facto public sphere. And not only are we seeing these corporations censoring, but we're seeing people who ought to know better demanding that they censor. And ironically, as Glenn Greenwald has pointed out, this was not a role any of these firms wanted. They were told, even by people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you do this or we will impose regulation on you. And that is a grave danger to our ability to reach people and to speak freely. And that worries me greatly, because what's left after that? If they shut us down, or if they successfully limit us, which unfortunately is happening, we've seen other dissenting publications being shut down. One example over the summer, Facebook shut down the page of the Gaza Health Ministry at the very moment when the coronavirus was starting to have widespread community transmission in Gaza. And and people in Gaza are dependent on Facebook to get public health and other information. We managed to get them to reverse that, and they apologized for it and claimed it was a mistake. But they've shut down the pages. Facebook has shut down the pages of a lot of Palestinian journalists and publications. And we've seen these corporations also teaming up. They say, well, we can't be fact checkers, so we're going to team up with independent groups to do this. Who are the independent, so-called independent groups that Facebook has partnered with? They include the Atlantic Council, which is basically NATO's think tank in Washington, which is funded by the US government, funded by European Union governments, funded by the Gulf regimes that we were just talking about. They're going to be your independent fact checkers. And we saw Facebook setting up a so-called oversight board, which was again an effort to appease the people demanding censorship. Who did they put on the oversight board? One of the people they put was Emi Palmor, the former director general of the Israeli Justice Ministry, who was in charge of getting things censored on Facebook for the Israeli government. So effectively, Facebook appointed an Israeli government censor to its oversight board, which is going to decide what you and I and everyone else can say on Facebook. It's a very dangerous situation. There is pushback to it, but unfortunately not enough. And frankly, I wish I had some good news, but I think it's going to be an increasing threat to all of our ability to organize and speak freely.
You've been listening to Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima in conversation with Professor Walter Hickson of the University of Akron, in a webinar sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم